74 State v. Dennis H. Ellen Hennick, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Dennis H. Ms. Hennick.
May it please the Court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent Dennis H. The issue today is whether Dennis, who poses no substantial probability of physical harm to himself, no substantial probability of harm to others, does not have impaired judgment that raises a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself, and is not unable to satisfy his basic needs such that there is any substantial probability of serious physical harm, should nonetheless be constitutionally able to be committed in this state. This case is not about whether there is a need to show dangerousness before commitment. Both parties have conceded that there is a constitutional need to show that someone is dangerous. There also is no question that the statute at issue today, what is the statute that's sometimes called the fifth standard, progresses one step beyond the unquestionably acceptable standards for involuntary commitment. There's also no question that our law, even before this statute, had provisions to deal with forcible medication under the guardianship statute of 880.07 subparagraph 1M.
Would he be eligible under that?
Dennis, assuming that he had a guardianship in place, yes, he would. There are two prior, there are two prior, at least two, actually, I'm not sure. I take that back. What that statute requires is two prior mental health commitments, but there is a time period. He would have to have had his last commitment within the last 18 months, and I believe at the date at which he was committed, that would not have been true. I think it had been longer than that.
Counsel, when you said there was no substantial probability, it just my ears could have, maybe I...
I'm sorry, Justice Wilcox, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I misinterpreted some of the facts here, but as I understand it, Dennis had been under care. Dennis as a caseworker and, mm-hmm. and doctor, these are the people who, as I understand it, signed the petition. In a situation where there has been substantial contact with someone who is allegedly mentally ill, are you saying there was no substantial probability here of any act either to himself or to others? There's nothing here that...
That's what the trial court found. The trial court dismissed the petition for commitment here on the other four standards, which was in essence a finding that no, there was no substantial probability of physical harm as evidenced by any recent threats. No, there was no substantial probability of harm to others based on threats or behavior. No, his judgment was not so impaired that there was a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself. And no, there was not an inability to satisfy his basic needs such that there was a substantial probability of serious physical harm. Now, having said that, he was at the point at which he was committed, there's no question that he was caring for many of his basic needs. He was handling his own money. There was food in his refrigerator. He did not lack for clothing. What there was a concern that a man who, and let's understand this, he was on his medications when he began to deteriorate. This is not somebody who went off his medications and then began to deteriorate. He began to deteriorate on his medications. After a period of time, he decided to go off of those medications. There was some concern that in the past, he had stopped eating at one time. There was some concern that his weight might be dropping. Yet after he was committed, the day after he was committed, when he was weighed, he came in substantially higher. He came in at 132 pounds, higher than the caseworker thought, in fact, he weighed when he asked for commitment. So there was no immediate harm to him. And there was no evidence that there would be immediate harm. If there had been, he would have been committable under the first four standards, and the trial court clearly ruled that he was not.
Ms. Hennick, had there been some previous episodes of renal failure?
There had been, I can't remember whether it's 10 years or 12 years, there had been much, much earlier a period of time in which he had stopped eating. He had been anorexic, and it had resulted in hospitalization. I can't recall off the top of my head whether that was renal failure. I believe it was, but I don't remember for sure. I know that he was hospitalized with some medical problems based on having starved himself, but that was a good 10 to 12 years earlier.
Well, the concern here related to renal failure, but then it was tied into weight loss, is that correct?
It was tied to his having starved himself. It was tied to anorexia. Now, one of the issues here, there are two issues here. One has to do with due process, one has to do with equal protection. I'd like to start with equal protection. And one of the reasons I'm going to start with equal protection, there are really two pieces to the equal protection argument. One is that Dennis H. is being treated differently than others who we forcibly medicate, specifically under 880.07. The other argument is that he's being treated differently from other people that we commit because the other people that we commit pose an immediate risk of danger to either themselves or someone else. I'm going to deal first with the medication issue because I think the other piece of it fits in with the due process more easily.
Now, just to stop you here, you think that subsection A is unconstitutional. That's your point.
I'm sorry?
Your point is that sub E, this fifth prong,
correct,
is unconstitutional.
Yes.
On its face.
On its face? Yes.
Are you also attacking that he doesn't fit it if it's constitutional?
Only to the extent that I'm not sure what the statute calls for, and there is a vagueness problem. I'm not sure whether he fits in because, quite honestly, I am not entirely sure what the statute requires.
Okay.
Now, as to equal protection, there are two things you look at. The first is whether groups are similarly situated. When you look at 880.07 sub 1M, and you look at the fifth standard, what you have are people who have a history of mental illness in both cases, who are considered to be treatable, who are considered to be incompetent to refuse medication, and who are arguably at some risk of harm. Now, the interesting thing if you look at these two statutes is that you can forcibly medicate someone under 880 only if they pose a higher risk than what's going on here in the fifth standard. Under 880, you can forcibly medicate if there is a risk of physical harm. Yet the deprivation, which is simply the medication, people under 880.07 are not committed, is much lower. It's not nothing, because forcible medication is something, but it's lower, because you can only do 880 as an outpatient. Dennis is committed and was at one time an inpatient and could be returned to inpatient status. If you look at the fifth standard versus 880, when you look at 880, there is more evidence of what the state is concerned about this revolving door. Under 880, to be forcibly medicated, you have to actually have been committable twice. Under the fifth standard, all you need is a treatment history. You don't have to have been committed at all, ever. You don't ever have to have been shown to be physically dangerous to anybody. All you have to have is a treatment history. You could be getting private treatment. You could never have been an inpatient before, and yet you could be subject to 880. Now, I'm sorry, subject to the fifth standard. Another difference is that for forcible medication and outpatient treatment, you have to have an immediate danger. You have to currently be unable to take care of yourself to satisfy your basic needs. If standard allows it, if there is some nebulous possible future harm, it requires a great prediction of very small harm. And one of the things we know is that psychiatrists are not wonderful about predicting harm, and that the lower the rate of harm that they're predicting, the less clear it gets. The other thing that you have is somebody under the fifth standard never has to have been shown to have been actually immediately dangerous. Under 880, because they've had to be committed two prior times, and when that statute was enacted, you only had the first four standards. I expect that at this point that would be different. You had to have been shown to have at one time been immediately dangerous. So you've got outpatient treatment and forcible medication if we know you've been dangerous. But if maybe you're going to be dangerous and you have some treatment history but you've never even necessarily been committable, we're going to commit you and throw you into inpatient treatment. There is no rational way to make distinctions between those two groups that way. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, how would you propose that the state handle somebody who we agree, I think, that he's chronically schizophrenic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's got a mental illness, right?
Right.
A mental illness that is treatable by drugs.
Possibly.
Probably.
Because maybe. Treatable doesn't say necessarily treatable by drugs.
No, but there's a chance here, right?
Okay.
And he has been on drugs, and I accept that the fact is that although on drugs was deteriorating, so those drugs apparently were not working well enough for the moment. Okay, but he's mentally ill, treatable by drugs, and he doesn't want to take them. And is not taking them. And so that leaves doubt in my mind as to whether he's really being rational, because so many people that could be treated with drugs will take drugs despite maybe side effects. So what does the state do with them to make sure that he is protected? He's not hurting anyone, but he might very well die himself, and the state doesn't want to see that. Now, if I had a broken leg, could the state force me to get it repaired?
No, the state can't. And I think what the state
even
has...
Even though I'm not rational, maybe that to some people I wouldn't be rational in keeping it broken. Is that right?
Well, actually, there medically are some circumstances under which you might be rational to keep it medically broken. If you have other health problems, for example, there might be.
What can the state do if I'm physically have a physical problem to make me take care of myself? Anything?
The state can't do anything until it's actually a threat to life. And even then it may be limited. Even then it's very limited. But certainly the state doesn't step in and say, you know, we know smoking is bad for you. We know we have evidence smoking will kill you. We know many people can quit if they take Zyban. There is nothing, and I don't think the state is ready to say, we can come in and say it's not rational for you not to take Zyban because we know smoking's going to kill you, so we're going to come in and do that.
Okay.
I think what the state has to do is the state has to wait and see. It may be that somebody off medication may deteriorate, but may never become dangerous. Once he becomes there's some danger of harm, you can step in. If the state had wanted to here, if there was enough harm, it may be that under 880 there may have been guardianship possibilities. As I said, I think that the last hospitalization was not quite ready and was not quite recent enough.
So your position is the state has to wait until it's imminently dangerous?
I think
itself or to others?
I think that the state does. I think that there are limitations. The fact that we have good motivations, and I'm not doubting anybody's motivation here, But the fact that the state has good motivations, our value system says there have to be limitations on what the government can do. Even when their motivations are good, there are things that we don't allow the government to do. We don't allow the government to say, look, we know this mother isn't that great, so, you know, we think maybe she wouldn't be because she's 16 and she's not very well educated, so we're going to step in right at the get-go and take that baby away. There are limits under our system, and the fact that someone is mentally ill does not change that.
In this area of predictability, so what you're saying is like the, if it's imminently dangerous or causing harm, that I think that's the fine line, that you know, it's difficult to predict, and what they use is the best people, psychiatrists, and then you're indicating that, you know, they can't make a very good call, but they indicate, if you didn't hear me, that the psychiatrist in this case would have to make a fine line call. And it's like the dog first bite. In other words, if someone is injured, the person or some other person is injured, that's the fine line that I think is being drawn here. And what the reason for my first question was looking at the history here and then trying to say, all right, looking at this case and this case alone, looking at what you're concerned about, and we are too, the constitutional due process, equal protection, how would one have acted? And if, I guess what you're saying is that there had to be, he'd have to perhaps become comatose, or where is that point? When would you want someone to act in the here of the state?
Okay, I think that those points are already in the law. I think we can say that if we had clear evidence that he was not eating, and that was not the case here, if we had clear evidence he was not eating, we'd have inability to satisfy basic needs. What we had was some suspicion, a belief he was losing weight, and he appeared to have been losing some weight. How much was not clear, and whether there was a stopping point he was willing to stop at was not clear. There may very well have come a point with Dennis where it would have been appropriate to step in. There might not have. One of the things that makes this area so very difficult is that, unfortunately, as many of us who have dealt with mental illness, whether in the courts or in families, there's not a straight line. If his psychiatrist had been willing to say, and he was not, because if he had, he would have met the first standard, that he was immediately in danger himself, he believed there was immediate danger of serious harm, we might have a different case, but that's not what happened here. And I think we need to keep that line, because once you cross that line, once you say, we can talk about emotional harm, I'm not even sure what emotional harm is. Is it emotional harm if other family members get upset and therefore are a little bit more distant? What does emotional harm mean? It is difficult to say what mental harm means, but we all can understand what physical harm means. And by having a clear line, you allow the state to protect people, but do it without overstepping its bounds and without mixing in places it doesn't want to go. If you start saying that this is okay, I don't see the distinction between this and the smoker I was talking about earlier. We know that that smoker has a very high probability of ending up with emphysema, lung cancer. You know, by the time they're, maybe not when they're 20, it's not imminent, but it might very well be by the time they're 50 or 60. What about the people out there who we know already have emphysema and are smoking? Are we ready to step in there?
Could I ask you, the law, this subsection E has been in place about 6 years?
Yes.
Could you describe what the experience has been?
There is not much evidence in the record here as to what the experience has been. In fact, there is none. There are discussions in the briefs about what the experience has been. I have pulled together some information, but it's really quite cloudy. We've had it for 6 years. I know that in Milwaukee County, this is the first case in which the fifth standard was used. That much I know for sure. I could find no statistics that suggest there's been less homelessness in the last 6 years, as some of the amicus have suggested. I found no evidence, and certainly if we're talking anecdotal, but I see no evidence in my caseload that we have fewer mentally ill people going to jail than we did before. There really are not good statistics, at least none that I am aware of.
You don't have any idea of how many people are committed under this fifth standard?
Well, as I said, I know in Milwaukee, this was the first case. I am aware of two or three cases from Waukesha, although there may very well be more. I am aware of one or two cases from Ozaukee County. But that's simply what I'm aware of, and that doesn't mean that there aren't other ones out there.
What would be the implications of declaring the statute unconstitutional for those people who had been committed under the fifth standard?
I think if it's declared unconstitutional, now in Dennis's case it's quite clear because he's under an extension now, but those stipulations for extension make it clear that if it's unconstitutional and the original commitment goes away, he is no longer under commitment. The implications are that they are no longer committed, and then you are back to, in some cases perhaps they are committable under one of the other standards. There are some, I'm aware of at least one mixed case in which someone has been committed under one of the original four standards plus the fifth standard. I would assume that that commitment would remain because it would still be good under the other standard. I think as a practical matter, what would happen once those commitments go away would depend on where those people are in their lives and what's going on. One of the things that happens with these commitments is, as you know, commitments are then extendable, and the standard for extending commitments is actually much, much weaker, which is natural because we assume that there's been some large dangerousness posed. But in this case, what you've got is it is almost impossible not to extend these commitments unless you decide somebody's no longer subject to medication.
Ms. Hennick, are you attacking the statute both on its face and as applied in this case, or just on its face?
I am attacking the statute on its face. I don't see much difference between Dennis H. and the way it would be applied here or to anybody else. I think the fact patterns are going to be fairly similar.
Well, Ms. Hennick, I know that you're attacking it on its face. I think you should do it. What is wrong? What does the statute seek to do? How does it seek to do it, and what's wrong with how it does it?
Okay, what the statute seeks to do, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to finish this because I see the yellow light just went on. What the statute seeks to do is to commit a group of people who have some treatment history, who doctors believe, or family members believe, but they're going to have to get a doctor behind it, if they go off their medications, will deteriorate, and it attempts, in essence, to keep them on those medications in belief that that will maintain their mental health better. That may or may not be correct, but that's what the attempt is. The attempt is, I believe, to make it easier to commit in hopes. Now, this statute allows less inpatient time. I think it's really aimed at trying to keep forcible medication orders over a large group of people, primarily outpatient, but not solely outpatient. Now, one of the interesting things is once you start commitment, other things start flowing from that. Dennis used to manage his own finances.
I'm not particularly interested in Dennis.
Okay.
I want to. You've only got a few minutes left, and I'm frustrated because I don't know where you believe the faults of the statute lie.
Okay, I think that they lie in a couple of places. Number one, it allows commitment without any showing of imminent physical danger. It allows commitment based on a treatment history and some sense that there will be emotional or mental harm. Now, the statute does mention physical harm, but it's in an alternative so that you don't need it. I think that that's the biggest problem here. That's the core of the problem. Can you commit someone who is in no danger of physical harm, no imminent danger of physical harm?
To himself or others?
To himself or to anyone else. Absolutely none. And I believe that that goes beyond what due process allows. And certainly when you sit it side by side with the other commitment standards, and when you sit it side by side with 880.07, what you have is more stringent, certainly next to 880, what you have is an ability to inpatient commit someone who poses less risk than the person who under 880 can only be subject to outpatient treatment. So it's flaws that it's also irrational when you set it with the other standards. You've got four standards that allow commitment under physical harm. They do not have automatic medication orders attached to them. You can get a forcible medication order, but it's not automatic. Here you've got somebody who's not in danger of physical harm, and automatically you also have a forcible medication order.
Well,
I think that's a problem as well.
It must be implicit in your argument that dangerous, imminent dangerousness to self or others is a constitutional requirement under due process, substantive due process.
Yes.
That's your argument.
Yes.
This is not an imminent danger provision under E.
No, it's not. There's no imminence requirement of the danger.
So therefore, you argue it's contrary to substantive due process.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hennig. Mr. Balestrieri, I have you down for 20 minutes, and then ceding 10 minutes of your time to an attorney who's been admitted by Pro Hoc Vici, a motion from the Treatment Advocacy Center of Arlington. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would like to introduce to you Attorney Mary Zadanowitz, who is the Executive Director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. The Treatment Advocacy Center is a public interest law firm based in Arlington, Virginia, which functions as an advocacy group to obtain treatment for mentally ill persons. And I'm going to divide my argument. I'm going to take 20 minutes, and I'm going to discuss mainly what we might call the legal issues in the case. Attorney Zadanowitz is an expert on mental health law, and she will try to answer any questions the court has that pertain more specifically to that specific area of the law. I think in reading the briefs filed by the various parties in their amici in this case, it was very interesting to see the different approaches that were taken. The public defender and their amici, I think, take a very adversarial approach. It's kind of an us against them attitude. It is they portray the situation as being the state against the mentally ill. We don't see it that way at all. We see it very differently. We see it as an us for us situation.
The state is here to help you, right?
We see this as a situation in which people who care about the mentally ill have tried to do something to provide care for those mentally ill people who are incapable of obtaining care for themselves. That's the way we see this.
Okay, that leads me to a question. Do you view E as a dangerousness standard, and do you think dangerousness, imminent danger to self or others, has to be shown to make this constitutional?
That's a several-part question, and let me
you can take it.
Let me try to answer each of the parts. I think, in my reading of the law, and this has been disputed by one of the people who filed an amicus brief on behalf of the state, but as I read the law, dangerousness is a requirement of substantive due process for the commitment of a mentally ill person. Imminent dangerousness
is not. Dangerousness is, but not imminent dangerousness. I see the fifth standard as requiring a finding of dangerousness before there can be commitment. And my position is that the fifth standard differs from the other four standards, principally in the fact that while it requires dangerousness for commitment, it doesn't require that danger be imminent.
I think you use the term, this is prophylactic intervention.
I've used that term, I guess, among others, yeah. And that's as good as any.
I'd like to address just a particular part of the statute. Like, I suppose it's under vagueness or whatever, but in starting with the statute, it's always a good starting point. It says that the individual is dangerous if he or she evidences the following. And the first one is an incapability of expressing an understanding of the advantages and disadvantages of accepting medication or treatment. Let's just take that phrase, incapability of expressing an understanding. I think I know a number of people who would be incapable of expressing an understanding, but are capable of understanding. How do you read that phrase?
Let me just preface that by saying that I do not stand here today claiming that this is the best written statute I've ever seen.
Well, this one really gave me problems.
It's a very badly written statute. No question about it. However, the mere fact that it is not well written does not equate with unconstitutionality. I mean, I think we all have an obligation. I have an obligation as a member of the executive branch to try to defend what the legislature has done. I think the court, by its own pronouncements, has an obligation as a member of coordinate branch of government to try to save what the legislature has done, if you can possibly do so, to show comity with the legislature. There are many words in this statute that indeed are troubling, and I
it's saying that you can commit somebody who is incapable of expressing.
Yeah, and I understand that, but I don't think that if you look at the statute as a whole, if you put it into the context of the entire Chapter 51 on mental health, that it is intended to say that we can commit somebody simply because they are inarticulate. I don't think that that's what they're talking about here. I don't think that the criteria for commitment is whether someone can write a nice little 10-page essay on what it means to get treatment or not to get treatment. I think when they are talking, when they use the term here about expressing an understanding, they're just talking about the most kind of rudimentary sorts of acknowledgement. Let's put it that way. I think acknowledgement would be a better word than expression. An acknowledgement that, yes, this is what would happen if I took the treatment. Yes, this is probably what would happen if I didn't take the treatment. And I think that expression can be by nothing more than the nod of a head. You know, do you understand that if you got the treatment, this is what would be likely to happen? Do you understand that this is what would be likely to happen if you didn't get the treatment? I mean, I think that's all that is sort of required. I don't think we're talking about committing somebody because they lack the ability to write a dissertation.
No, of course not. But it gets you past the first step. And that's what I'm concerned about. Clearly, when they set this statute up, the legislature set up a number of steps. You can't go to step two until you pass step one. And step one here is they can pass step one. and go to step two, it seems to me, if they are simply incapable of expressing an understanding. Because then once they do that, then if they could tie in step two, which is evidencing a substantial probability that they need care and treatment, the state is on its way to committing this person.
Right, and as I say, I think we have to read that term expression in a reasonable way so that we're not talking about asking someone to make the same kinds of erudite statements that a professional psychiatrist would make about the advantages and disadvantages, but we're just talking about someone who is just able to demonstrate in some rudimentary way a comprehension, the ability to comprehend.
You and I could draft a lot clearer language
I could draft a much better statute. Anyone in this room could draft a much better statute. The high school students here could draft a better statute.
Mr. Balistrary, isn't that linked to because of mental illness? And as you are about to criticize the legislature, was there no relationship between the Department of Justice and the drafting of the statute back in the mid-90s?
To my knowledge, we were never involved in this.
Well, where have you been for the last 6 years?
Where have we been?
Yes. If you didn't like the language, where have you been to try to correct it?
Well, we are not the legislature, Justice Prosser.
Well, now, wait a minute. The Department of Justice is offering language changes all the time to bills and is sometimes holding up bills because they don't like the language. I think for you to sit there and criticize the language when the department hasn't done anything, I find personally offensive. Now, let's get back to the question. Isn't this incapability language linked to because of mental illness?
Yes, it is. Of course it is.
Okay. I didn't hear you say that.
The suggestion, I think, is made that it's an either-or, either incapable of expressing or incapability of applying and understanding. And then there's a comma, as demonstrated by both the individual's treatment history and his recent acts or omissions, and the individual needs care or treatment to prevent further disability or deterioration, and the substantial probability that if he or she is left untreated, lacks services, and that there will be severe mental, emotional, or physical harm. So either he can't or she can't express it, or they show an incapability of applying and understanding. So they can't say it, but and then not only can't they say it, but they won't take the drugs. And you get severe mental, emotional, physical harm. And then you can't function independently in the community. Then you are under this statute. Is that the way it reads?
I think it's the way, that's the way it reads.
Then isn't this an incompetent statute, not a dangerousness statute?
That I think it's both.
Incompetent.
It's both. You have to be both incompetent and dangerous before you can be committed.
What part of this is dangerous?
I'm sorry?
What part of this is dangerous?
The last part of it, the part that says that you are incapable of functioning independently in the community.
But this will result in the loss to function independently, or the loss, but it doesn't say when.
It does not say when.
That's right. Suppose this won't occur, at best prediction, for 2 years. Suppose this guy weighed 200 pounds and it would take 2 years at this rate for him to be in danger because of loss of weight. Can you institutionalize him now?
Oh, I doubt very much, because the statute requires a standard of reasonable probability. And, you know, as we say in other contexts...
Where does it say that?
It must be here, up toward the...
By the next sentence. It says the probability of suffering severe mental, mental, emotional, physical harm is not substantial, if reasonable provision of the individual's care is available in the community, okay?
Right.
And then says there's a reasonable probability that the individual avail himself. Doesn't say anything about reasonable time in any of that.
Well, the word substantial probability is about the 10th line down. I understand this is a very long statute, but evidence is a substantial probability is demonstrated, blah, blah, of further deterioration and a substantial probability that left untreated, this will happen. So the phrase substantial probability is actually repeated a couple of times.
I'm sorry, tell
within
me
the
what
statute.
That is. Is that in the next sentence?
Yeah, it's repeated several times within the context there, so that in any event, it must be substantially probable that the harm that the statute really seems to deal with, it must be substantially probable that that harm is going to occur. And of course, if we say that nothing is going to happen, or reasonably probable, nothing is going to happen for 2 years, then I don't think we can say that there is a reasonable or substantial probability that the harm that we're concerned about is going to occur, at least at this point, because a lot of things can happen in the next 2 years. I mean, I think there has to be some kind of immediacy requirement read into the statute. It doesn't have to be right now, but within the reasonably foreseeable future.
So to make this constitutional, we have to read in an immediacy requirement.
No, I don't think so. I think we already have. I think we already have the phrase reasonably probable, which creates the kind of situation where we can say, and of course, anytime you use the word reasonable, it has to be based on the particular facts of the particular case, but I think we have to say, in any case, before we commit somebody, that there is a real danger that if this person isn't committed, we're going to have these problems that we want to avoid.
Let me see if I understand your argument. As I understand your argument, you are saying that the dangerousness component, number one, has to be in the statute for substantive due process.
And it is.
And it is. But of course, we don't see the word dangerousness in here. But
well, actually, it is in there.
Oh, is it in there somewhere?
It's in the very first.
It's hard to find.
No, well,
you got to look back into that. I'll take that back. Because I want to get to the last, because you seem to say that the dangerousness component rests in the final few words of the statute, where that clause will result in the loss of the individual's ability to function independently.
Yes.
Now, I presume that what you're saying is we have to read in there to function independently to the point where the person is a danger to himself or to others.
Well, I think that by definition, a person who is unable to function independently in the community, which means that in essence, the person cannot provide food, care, clothing, shelter, that person by definition is dangerous.
I've just had a recent experience with a person that was unable to function independently, and no one would say that that person should be able to be committed. There's a lot of people, Mr. Pallister, that need nursing care, that are unable to take care of themselves. But certainly no one would say that they should be committed. So, I mean, to say that just the function, the individual's ability to function independently by itself is enough to commit someone.
No, it's not.
Sends terrors through my head.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And I want to stress that. You can't say that anyone can be committed because one of the several factors that has to be met for commitment is met. You have to meet all of the factors. You have to have somebody who's mentally ill. You have to have somebody who's deteriorating. You have to have somebody who needs treatment to arrest the deterioration. You have to have somebody who is incapable of making an informed decision to accept that treatment. You have to have a situation where the deterioration is such that there's a reasonable probability that it is going to lead to the point where this person is absolutely helpless.
Counsel? I want to focus on your need for real danger, because you're suggesting that dangerousness isn't sufficient, that he's going to be dangerousness or she's going to be there's going to be dangerousness, that is, he or she will be endangered 10 years from now. That's not what you're talking about.
Right.
By real, do you mean imminent?
No, I don't mean imminent.
What do you mean by real with regard to something temporal? Is it real if it's, and I don't mean to trap you, sometimes you say, is it real by 5 years, 3 years, but what I really want to know is what you mean by real. Because you don't want to say imminent, but you say real. Dangerousness 10 years from now isn't going to cut it. So what does real dangerousness mean with regard to some kind of temporal quantification?
I think that has to be, I can't say that. I can't give you an answer that is definitive, because I think it depends on the circumstances of each individual case, and I think this rests on the professional judgment of the medical professionals who are making these decisions.
If you can't give an answer, fair enough. Where does the statute give an answer? Where does the statute say that, you point to, it will result in the loss of the individual's ability to function independently in the community, etc.? Where is the real component set forth in the statute?
I think that is part of the reasonable probability.
Well, that doesn't give any, there can be a reasonable probability that 10 years from now, the person will be unable to function independently.
Yeah, but see, that it's the reasonable part. It's the reasonable part. What is reasonable under these circumstances? Is a danger 10 years from now reasonable to warrant a commitment? No. Is a danger 1 year from now? Maybe it is.
Well,
depending on the facts of the particular case.
Understandably so. But it seems to me now you're taking the term reasonable probability that will result in the loss of the individual's ability to function and saying, but we look at this from a common sense, reasonable sort of way. And I need to know in the statute, on its face, where you find the real, not just the dangerousness, but the real component of the dangerousness, which you say is necessary in order to meet constitutional standards.
I can't point you to a specific word. I think that...
A phrase? Can you give anything in the statute that requires the real dangerousness?
Other than the substantial probability. That's the closest I can point you to a phrase.
One final question. The substantial probability... an inability. The substantial probability doesn't refer to time period, though.
No, it doesn't refer to time. No, but I think timing is an inherent component of any reasonable professional decision to commit someone. I mean, I think that's just part of the professional process, that you're not a medical professional is not going to commit somebody unless that professional feels that there is a genuine need to commit that.
Yes, but it almost sounds like unless it's real, unless it's really going to happen imminently. You don't want to use that term.
I don't want to use that term.
But
within a reasonable time.
You're awfully close to using it. It's just that it's distasteful to use it.
I have... I don't want to use the word imminent because I think that's what distinguishes the fifth standard from the other four standards.
Right. You can't use it because you'll fall into A through D.
Yeah.
No, we're talking about something that is a little bit different, that we're talking about somebody who isn't quite there on the A through D standards, but it's going to get there. It's going to get there. And I would like to turn the microphone over to attorneys.
I have a question, if I may, too.
Just to say.
Isn't the whole problem with this statute the fact that it defines dangerous by simply repeating the definition of mental illness?
Oh, it does not simply repeat the definition of mental
illness. Well, it does, to the extent that the dangerousness component of the fifth standard, and you've admitted this throughout the last 20 minutes, is contained in the language that pertains to the substantial probability of decompensation, essentially, such that the individual will be unable to function independently. And that's the definition of mental illness.
So if that's the dangerous component,
then all the statute does is repeat the definition of mental illness and there is nothing more.
There is a small but very important difference between the inability to function phraseology in the definition of mental illness and in the phraseology in the fifth standard. In the definition of mental illness, a person is considered mentally ill if the ability to function is impaired. That's all it requires is an impairment. For commitment under this standard, impairment is not sufficient. There has to be a loss of the ability. It can't just be 5% gone, 10% gone, 15% gone. It has to be gone before there's commitment. And I think in terms of comparing the dangerousness for the fifth standard with the definition of mental illness, it's the difference between simple impairment, which is just a degree of loss, to the whole idea that you have to have a complete loss of the ability to function before you can have commitment under this standard. So it's not the same.
You read the fifth standard as requiring a total incapacity.
Loss. It says the word is loss, not impairment, but loss.
And Dennis now has a complete loss, or at least the petition had a complete loss?
Well, there was a finding by the circuit court that, well, he doesn't have it now. He doesn't have it now. But there was a finding by the circuit court that if he continued to deteriorate without treatment, that condition would be reached. So I will now turn it over to Attorney Zedanowicz. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bilastri. Counsel.
Good morning. Mary Zedanowicz, representing the Treatment Advocacy Center. And I thank you for the opportunity to address the court this morning. More than 25 years ago, Wisconsin native Judge David L. Bazelon, whose landmark decisions pioneered the field of mental health law, wrote about involuntary commitment criteria and cautioned us to keep an open mind. He wrote that judgments are neither fixed nor frozen, that they can be altered in response to new information, new understandings, and new public demand. The Wisconsin's fifth standard is such a response to what has been a revolution in our understanding of and ability to treat severe mental illnesses. Research in the last decade has enabled us to understand that treatment refusal in the most severe mental illnesses, schizophrenia and manic depression, is caused by a neurological deficit that is actually part of the illness. That neurological deficit impairs a person's ability to make a rational decision about treatment, and thus the fifth standard's provision concerning the inability to make an informed choice is critical to this discussion. Other recent discoveries, though, weigh in favor of the early intervention, early treatment provided by the fifth standard. Research suggests that after experiencing involuntary commitment, patients have a better understanding and attitude towards treatment, and that in fact they are more likely to then in the future seek treatment voluntarily. But weighing most heavily in favor of early treatment intervention are the consequences of non-treatment. Suicide, homelessness, victimization, episodes of violence, and incarceration, which is all too common for people with severe mental illness in this country now. Data from states that have standards substantially similar to the fifth standard, Wisconsin's fifth standard, show that we can reduce homelessness, reduce arrests, reduce violence.
Counsel, may I interrupt you and ask, in those states, has this standard been challenged on a constitutional basis?
Actually, the one state, New York, has been challenged and was upheld as constitutional. But the discovery, I think, that is most relevant to what we're talking about is something that we've only learned about in the last 10 years, and that is that neurological deficit, anosognosia. We also call it lack of insight, is a common way to refer to it. But it is absolutely critical. In 1990, 10 years after the fourth standard was enacted, we only had 19 studies of anosognosia in psychotic patients. But by 1995, when the fifth standard was introduced, there were 70 empirical studies of anosognosia in severe mental illness. And what we found was that this lack of insight, anosognosia, this inability to have a full awareness of the impact of the mental illness on the individual, that the person's inability to even sometimes comprehend that they have a mental illness, is significantly related to non-treatment and rehospitalization. There are three very important kinds of insight. There is first the awareness that a person has a mental illness. A second is an awareness of the effects of medication. And the third is the social consequence of the mental illness. Now, that second one, that ability to understand the effect of medication, Justice Babich, I think that goes to the question that you asked about whether the person is capable of expressing that they understand the effect of the medication. And I think a good example is a person who lacks insight about the symptoms that they're experiencing. For example, if they hear voices in their head. Well, part of insight is being able to attribute that symptom. And sometimes people with severe mental illness aren't able to attribute the voices to the mental illness. And in fact, very commonly we hear, now the voices are caused by the CIA. The CIA has implanted a chip in my tooth, or it used to be aliens are transmitting voices into my head. Well, when the doctor explains to that patient that this medication will help reduce those voices that you're hearing, do you understand that? The patient says no, because it is the CIA. The medication can't make the CIA stop transmitting voices to my head. That person is unable then to express an understanding of the effect of medication.
Counsel, as I read the statute, it seems that the entire basis, correct me if I'm wrong, but I take it you are also very well aware of the statute.
Yes.
That the basis for it rests on predictions of the medical community. The word substantial probability appears throughout, and those are necessarily predictive, and that courts are going to need, those with the power to commit, are going to need medical predictions. Now, nowhere in the statute does any standard appear as to who can do this. And I have no doubt that the science is, as you say, that there have been great strides made. But it seems to me that one of the dangers I see in the statute is that a lot of medical people do not have this knowledge, do not have this ability to make good predictions, but their credentials may appear, in fact, to be sufficient. And so without, and one of the reasons, of course, that you know with the first four standards that we've gone along with that is because there has to be something more. There has to be the recent overt acts of dangerousness to himself or others. Very recent, and that's not the case here. So we have to be very careful. Now, isn't that a concern of yours?
Well,
or is that a concern of yours?
Let me answer that by saying that this standard still requires recent acts and omissions, but it also relies on a prior history, a prior treatment history. Now, recent acts and omission, prior treatment history. This is really aimed at the revolving door patients, the people that we see who just keep going off medication, you know, get stabilized, go off medication again. It is those people that I've been talking about who lack the insight to know that they need to stay on medication to stay well. Now, because it is based on recent acts and prior history, what I happen to know from experience is that the people that we're talking about very often have the same cycle in their illness. And when a judge is listening to the professional, what they will hear most likely is, in the past, the individual went off their medication and exhibited X symptoms. And the result was they became suicidal, they ended up in jail. I mean, there are a number of very dire outcomes. But that cycle tends to be repeated over and over again, and I think that is the intent of this statute, is to try to help prevent and stop that cycle from happening. So it is very common that doctors are able to predict because the clients that they're talking about have experienced the same thing over and over again.
Counsel, I was on the MacArthur mental health study that's referred to in various provisions. And prediction is not 100%. There's debate in the medical fields about how good prediction is and who is the best predictor. There's also a running debate between the patients and their families in treatment. The patient wants more freedom to determine his or her own life. And if they make the wrong decisions, they want it their decisions. And the treatment groups and families want to be very protective because they believe, as I understand the debate, that they can help, or at least even if they turns out it's not helpful, they've tried, right? And it seems to me that E has adopted the latter position.
Well,
you agree?
Interestingly, we can't paint with a broad brush what patients feel and what families feel.
Right.
Because, in fact, on my staff and on the board of directors of the Treatment Advocacy Center and people that are very strong supporters of what we are doing, which is
who have been mentally ill and have gone through this process.
They are individuals who have severe mental illness, who have been psychotic, who have been there, who have experienced homelessness, who have been thrown in jail, who are doing this now because they don't want to see that happen to them again. They want to know that if they do lose their ability to make those rational decisions, somebody will be able to step in before it's imminently dangerous. Because what we do also know is that waiting until it's imminently dangerous, we lose too many people that way.
That's the public policy behind it.
Yes. It is the public policy, and it is part of the weighing of the state's interest, and it's part of the very important weighing of the individual's right. The individual, I assert, when they're not able to make a rational decision. By not doing anything, aren't we making a decision for them?
And that's the policy that's expressed, I take it, in the first part of the statute.
Yes.
In other words, you don't get past, you have to be either incapable of expressing an understanding or substantial incapability of applying an understanding of the advantages, et cetera. That's the policy.
That's correct. And it's based on, as I started out by saying, what we now understand about these illnesses. And that's what distinguishes mental illnesses, which I assert are physical illnesses, from illnesses in other parts of the body. The part that we're using to make a decision about treatment is the part that is impaired. And if we are not able to make a rational decision, then we need to look at balancing at what point on how long we allow a person to go before we intervene, particularly when, as in this fifth standard, we can predict what's going to happen. And it's only used when there is a substantial probability that the same thing that happened before is going to happen again. Why make people go through the same revolving door? The other important point, though, is that for someone who lacks insight, who's not able to recognize that the symptoms that they're experiencing, that the voices that they hear are part of their illness, until you actually get treatment for them so that they can experience what it is like on a long-term basis, they can experience what it is like not to have voices in their head, they will never be able to develop insight. So this is a way to help them develop the ability to voluntarily participate in treatment.
Your time is up, but Justice Bambridge has a question.
You indicated that New York has a statute that addresses the policies behind the fifth standard. What other states are there that have that you're aware of?
There are now about half of the states have what I would call a standard that's based on a substantial probability of harm occurring. So about half the states, and that is by far the trend. We have seen a number of states over the last several years begin to amend their mental illness treatment laws.
Do you have a citation to the New York case?
I don't, but I would...
Could you provide that,
provide
to,
that the court?
And to opposing counsel?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to take us back to the statute because I am concerned that something has been inadvertently lost in the discussion of the statute. We seem to agree that there needs to be some dangerousness. And the portion that the state has pointed to is that there's a substantial probability that it will result in the loss of an individual's ability to function independently. The statute, however, does not require that. There is an or. And if you follow that phrase, what you get is they have to prove either that they won't be able to independently function or that there's a loss of cognitive or volitional control over thoughts and actions. And if you look at the definition of mental illness, what you see is basically what we're talking about is that there will be mental illness.
Well, counsel, although Mr. Balistrieri didn't seem to agree with me, I was really trying to help him because I felt that at least what his argument should be, if it wasn't, was that the element of dangerousness should be read in by this court to both of those. In other words, the ability to function independently in the community, the inability to function independently to the point of dangerousness to himself or others, or the loss of cognitive or volitional control over his or their thoughts of actions that are dangerous to himself or others. Because I agree, just standing alone, that language is extremely concerning.
And I would suggest...
But we, of course, have to try to make the statute constitutional if we can.
And I think that's part of what would need to be done. I think there would need to be another piece to it, and I suggested it in my brief. If you were to say that you read that in, and it must be physical harm, I think that you would have a constitutional statute. If it's if you've got some, a little bit of imminence, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned that any of this can be predicted for 10 years out. So if you were to read in that plus the harm being physical, because one of the concerns here is that I don't think this court or anybody sitting here could explain exactly what emotional harm actually is. I mean, we have some sense of it, but I hate to try and define it for a jury. I don't think I could.
Physical harm already is one of the alternatives in the statute, so it's not a matter of reading in a physical harm requirement. It's a matter of saying that mere emotional harm is not enough. Is that
yes.
your argument?
Yeah, I think what you have to do is not make it an alternative, but make it an absolute. It must be there.
Does severe modify physical or just mental?
I'm honestly not sure. I've looked at this three times. I think if I had to guess what the intent was, I would guess it was severe harm. But I think you can make a grammatical case for no, it only applies to mental.
So
I would like to see it read in as severe physical harm, especially since the farther, the more attenuated you get, I think the greater you have, the more careful you have to be about what kind of harm you're talking about.
Where do you have your proposed reading in? Or you can give it to me.
I don't think I fleshed it out quite that well. I think what I suggested was that to avoid page 23 of my brief.
Where I am.
Oops. It should have been. Oh dear. Something happened in the index. I really apologize for that.
Try page 20. Try page 20.
I apologize for that. It's on page 20. Something must have happened when that was typed in. I apologize.
If this court so construes the statute, it should vacate commitment. So where do we construe it?
I think what you would have to do is a couple of things. I think that you would have to take out the alternatives, mental and emotional, but that would have to come out. The trickier piece is I think that there's still a concern about, I mean, that will result in the near future. I think it's got to be not resulting in loss of cognitive or volitional control. I think you have to go to the ability to function independently. Because I think we'll suffer severe physical harm that will result in loss of control. I'm not sure that makes any sense when you do it that way. I think if you try and strike that, you end up with something that doesn't make sense.
To avoid a finding of unconstitutionality, this court should construe a 2E to require a finding of physical harm and remand to the trial court for determination whether by clear and convincing evidence the state should show a substantial probability.
Is that the fire
is not part of Law Day. This is the first Wednesday of the month, and they test the alarms at about 11. Is it 11 or 12?
Thank you. Those of us who've been in 11. Fires were having a little trouble standing here during that.
And we're displaying all the new facilities in our renovated courtroom, and this is one of them. So you may proceed with that in mind, and you are all safe. The moment.
I'm sorry, that is I've completely lost my
time. I was reading from page 20 that we would have to read, we'd have to delete certain words from the statute. And you would have to read severe physical harm, and then it has to be vacated so that we remand to the circuit court to apply this new standard of showing a substantial probability that failure to treat would result in physical harm.
Right, because I'm not sure how that would come out in this particular case. Because what we can't know is whether what portion of the statute the jury was applying, and that was why I was suggesting that if this court were to do that, we would need to remand and redo this.
And the jury was instructed under E?
Yes.
And that instruction is part of the record?
I believe so, yes.
Yes.
Any further questions?
Seeing none, that concludes our hearing in 01-0374.